You're listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician. Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 63 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, your host for the show. And before we jump into today's episode, I wanted to say welcome to all of our new listeners that found the podcast through the DIY Musician email newsletter that we just started at CD Baby. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and you can do that through iTunes or any other podcatching service like Mediafly. Also, if you go to the podcast website, which is cdbabypodcast.com, you can subscribe by email. So if you'd like to get the podcast to your inbox, you can do that there. And speaking of the podcast website, there is info there about how you can join in on the conversation. So if you want to weigh in on an episode or make a comment, there's lots of ways in which you can connect with us, and we like that a lot. It's always fun to get to know you and dialogue back and forth. So I encourage you to do that. And we're also on Twitter, so you can follow the podcast on Twitter at twitter.com/cdbaby_podcast. Well, the music industry is rapidly changing. It's in the news constantly, and it has big implications for the indie artist. New opportunities are popping up on a weekly basis, and one of the ways I personally stay up to date is by reading a blog called Hypebot. You can find it at hypebot.com, and they try to focus in on articles that point to where things are going, both for the music industry at large and the DIY indie artist world. The blog is curated by Bruce Houghton, who has run his own booking agency, Skyline Entertainment, for years. And having worked directly with artists both big and small for many years, Bruce seems to have a good pulse on where things are headed and how artists need to adapt to the changes. So I thought Bruce would be a great person to have on the podcast to talk about how his business and artists are dealing with the change and share some ideas of where things are headed. So let's get to my interview with Bruce. Well, Bruce, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
You have a blog called Hypebot and an artist agency named Skyline Music, and we're going to talk about both of those today. I'm not sure how many of our listeners are directly familiar with Hypebot, but I know they're familiar with the content as I pass around your articles on Twitter all the time, and it's one of my favorite music business blogs. How did you get started in the music business and end up where you're at today?
I was going to Boston University in journalism and did a internship at a record label, A&M Records. In those days, and we're talking about 30 years ago, 30 plus years ago, record labels had branches in most major cities, and they had a branch in Boston. So I did an internship there, worked for them for a while after college, and one thing led to another. And 25 years ago, I founded a booking agency, Skyline Music, that I still run. And at the time, it was just doing local bands and booking things like, I used to book The Rat in Boston, which was this sort of CBGB-style punk club, book the Police for $300 a night for three nights, those kind of things. So I've been doing this a long time and built the agency over a period of time into a national and even international company. And then about in 2005, I started to see changes in the music business really accelerating, and the model that we had used previously, which was to, in essence, you'd bring a band along and find them a manager, and the manager would find them a record label, and the record label would finance the record, and more importantly, as far as I was concerned as an agent, would also help promote the record, promote the artist, and promote the dates when the artist toured. All of that was kind of going out the window. So I saw that I needed to learn about that so that I could teach the artists that are under our care about the changes in the music business. So HiPod started almost as an internal document about what I was learning, but I didn't really care if anybody else saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, more and more people started to read it. And so every day I post 4, 5, 6 things that are sort of a mixture of news and DIY tips and services that people could use. We call it the new music business because while occasionally I'll print, you know, a new vice president got hired at EMI, mostly what it's about are the kind of digital tools that are powering what I believe to be the future of the music business.
So it just started out as something to do as your artist, and it's kind of become a bit of a industry sounding board, because I know a lot of people in the industry also reference HiPod a lot. How has that changed what you do with the blog?
It really hasn't changed it a lot. I mean, I write with a point of view. I suppose perhaps now that, you know, things like this are hard to measure, but, you know, 15 or 20,000 people unique visitors a week look at the blog. So I suppose I'm a little bit more cautious about being critical
mm-hmm.
about somebody. I've never been a mean person, so I don't attack for the sake of attacking. But sometimes, you know, today, for example, MySpace introduced some new something called the music feed. It's part of their attempt to do more original content and programming. And, you know, they just did, in my opinion, a horrible job of the design. So I'll write about something like that.
But mm-hmm.
I don't think MySpace is going to rise or fall by my comment.
I'll leave my commentary out of there for right now as well. So the blog is seems to have taken off. What does it take to keep a blog going at that level? It seems like a lot of work.
Yeah, I mean, it's the other part of it is that I am not much of a sleeper, so it gets me. I spend about 2 hours on it every morning, starting at about 5:30, and then maybe throughout the day another half hour to an hour of, you know, something quick that just strikes me,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe preparing something for tomorrow. And, you know, I start off by looking at, I probably have 100, 120 feeds, if you will, other blogs and websites and news sources that I look at in my RSS reader every day, and then another 100 or so that I look at every couple of days. And basically what I'm scanning for are things that are going on in the industry that I think my readers would be interested in, and things that, you know, I feel like I need to know about. I mean, that's really, you know, the way I've always viewed this is I'm a student of the music business. And, you know, a long time ago, I meant reading Billboard cover to cover. And even though I was never going to, for example, be an agent for country music, I could tell you, you know, who Toby Keith was, because
mm-hmm.
it always seemed to me that I should know that. If I was going to be in the music business, I needed to know that. Just like if you were the ambassador to Italy, you still need to know what the politics are that are going on in South America, because you are by trade a diplomat. So that's how I've always looked at it, and that's what HiPod is, I, you know, what are the things that I think I need to know about, and some of them in depth and some of them on a more surface level. And so I try to share that information with the people that read the blog, and often, you know, in a very quick way, here's an overview of, you know, a new application, and if you want to know more, here's a link.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it's all about for me. It's making sure that I'm on top of things and sharing it.
So it's more of a place where you aggregate content that you find interesting, as opposed to just directly writing original content daily.
Well, I probably once a day, one of the 4 or 5 things that I post a day, or at least 4 or 5 things I post a week, are much more original content, and I'll take some little piece of information and go off on a tangent about, you know, my experience,
mm-hmm.
experiences in the industry, or what I think something means in a broader sense to the industry. And then also I've got, he started off as an intern, but now we call him the associate editor. He's a real help to me, a guy named Kyle Bylan, who's just a real thinker. And, you know, his pieces tend to be thought pieces. So it's I would say probably 20% of what we do on the blog is our, I call them essays or commentaries, and the rest of them tend to be shorter pieces that are more informational.
I've always thoroughly enjoyed it, so I definitely recommend our readers staying up with Hypebot. You seem to have a good pulse of information that's useful. There's a lot of blogs out there that seem to focus on stuff that I personally don't find useful to where music's going or just not interesting to me, but I always find something interesting on Hypebot. So
Thanks. That's
you're doing a good job there.
Good.
Well, let's talk about your artist agency, Skyline Music. What services do you provide to your artists?
We're primarily a booking agency. That's what we are first and foremost. We book live entertainment all over the country, and to some degree, probably about 20% of the roster we also do internationally. And the talent ranges all over the boards from, Reverend Peyton's Big Damn Band, who are, put their first record out on Side One Dummy this year and are out struggling, in 200 and 300 seat clubs and starting to make a name for themselves, and to, Nancy Sinatra, who's pushing 70 and plays only a few big concerts a year, and we work with some symphony orchestras. We do all kinds of things, so it's a very broad roster, and we enjoy doing that. In addition to booking, probably 50 or 60% of the artists that we represent don't have managers, so we're often not acting specifically as managers, but stepping in when they need us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're increasingly getting involved in digital marketing. The touring industry, in our opinion, is in a kind of an interesting place where, really, up until just a couple of years ago, an artist went on a tour and the record label did the tour publicity, and the promoter bought an ad in the weekly news magazine and weekly music magazine, and perhaps contacted the right radio station if it was a radio band, and got them involved. And those, that combination of the record label doing PR, the music weekly, and perhaps radio was enough to sell a show. Well, the record label's no longer doing that, if there is even a record label, or they're not doing it very well, and the promoter may or may not have access to radio anymore because it's gotten so, it's a conglomerate, mm-hmm. it's expensive, it's this. And the Music Weekly doesn't have the reach that it used to have. So that means that artists have had to take a greater role in promoting their own dates and developing their own email lists and doing online marketing and social networking and all of those kinds of things. And we find that, and that the promoters have been forced to do that as well. But we find that a lot of the artists and most of the promoters are not well equipped to do that. So increasingly we're getting involved in producing, banners for each dates and making sure they're web banners and making sure they're used and, turning people on to this is how you advertise a show on Facebook cost effectively and those kinds of things. So we're doing more and more digital marketing and also aligning ourselves with a few service providers that'll work with our artists on a reduced fee basis so that they get tour press or they get the kind of things mm-hmm. that they need. So we take on a pseudo-management role, but I don't want to pretend we're managers. We're not. And mm-hmm. we actually love working with great managers. We have a few. But many artists, there aren't a lot of great managers, and some artists don't want them, and some artists don't need them, and we do what we need to do.
So what are you looking for in an artist when you're adding new talent to your roster? It sounds like most of it is just independent artists that you're working with.
Yeah, independent or a lot of, probably about half of them were on major labels and or maybe a little more than half and aren't anymore. But what we look at is, whatever level or musical genre, frankly, it's their ability to tour and make money, because first and foremost, we're a business and we have bills to pay and we have staff to pay. And I look at an artist, sadly, I look at an artist's draw. We like to say, are you at least drawing 300 or 400 people or 200 or 300 people in 3 or 4 distinct markets, not just your hometown where your big Italian family can fill a club, mm-hmm. but in a couple of places, other places. And then we get on the phone and we talk to club owners and we say, hey, not do you like this band, but is this band growing? Did they do 300 people last time and and the time before that it was 250. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for some kind of draw, some kind of momentum. And then next comes team. And team is a somewhat nebulous thing, but it can be anything from a really activist band, not just one guy in a band, but occasionally there are bands that, you know how to divide up their tasks or have put together some kind of a team around them, which could include a manager or a label or a publicist or a digital marketing. I mean, it could be all kinds of things, what a team means, but some kind of a team, because as much as, you know, it'd be great to think you can be a one-man army, I'm not convinced that you can be.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be in the beginning. You have to wear all those hats. I mean, I'm fond of saying to artists who come to me, you know, they say, when's the right time to come to an agent? And I like to, and I say, all right, well, how hard would you work, or what kind of person do you think you could attract on 10 or 15% of what you make? And if the answer is not a very good person, then you're not ready for an agent.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, as crass as it may sound, that's really what it's all about. And it's not to say that we don't take bands and, you know, are making $500 a night and lose money on them for a year or two or three until they, you know, start making five times that. It's just to say that if we're going to do that, there has to be a good team and there has to be a path to success. And frankly, in this climate, we have to see that there's organic growth, that the audience is responding to them. I don't mean to go on, but the final thing is I often say to everybody that works for me, don't look at the band, look at the audience. And it's not to say that we don't, you know, need to feel good or passionate about the things that we represent. And sometimes we sign things just because we love them. But for the most part, is the audience reacting to them in some kind of visceral way that are going to make them tell their friends and come back and want to give them money to see the next show or buy the CD or the T-shirt or whatever it is?
Well, I think that's good advice, especially the idea of having a team around you. I mean, this is the DIY musician podcast, and a lot of artists listening are having to do things on their own, but to step up to the point of getting other people involved, like a manager or a booking agent, you're definitely going to have other people involved with your career. Otherwise, you're not going to have time to do your part of the bargain.
You know, and I've written on the blog about, in the beginning, your team is your band and maybe your sister and your mother, you know, but defining their tasks as if you were a business, as if you were putting, you know, a business together, because ultimately you are, is important. And in the beginning, the team probably is your band. And if the drummer isn't willing to spend 2 hours a week on MySpace, you know, or do something else, I mean, everybody has their own talent. Maybe, mm-hmm. you know, maybe the bass player is great at keeping the van fixed and the drummer doesn't mind spending 10 hours a week on MySpace. But if everybody's got to contribute, and if you don't have that kind of team effort, it's going to be hard.
You kind of alluded to the fact that you've taken on some artists and had lost some money on them for a couple years. Do you sometimes take on artists thinking, I know that this is going to be popular, it's not doing what it should be yet, under normal circumstances?
Oh, absolutely, we do. Yeah, yeah. And again, what that has to do often is are we alone in that feeling? Because if we are alone in that feeling, I'll tend to walk away from it. Meaning that if there is a manager or a label or something, sometimes it's three club owners from, you know, Indiana and Wisconsin that'll call us and go, you know what, this band is playing our club and you just have to pay attention to it. And not one club owner, but three club owners are going to get us to turn our heads. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, we do definitely look at things and say, this is what we can do. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. You know, sometimes we have to say, come back to us, you know, when you start to feel momentum, because I can't create momentum for an artist. And I'm not sure in this day and age, for outside of perhaps pop and hip hop, that anybody can create momentum for an artist, and that artist that momentum when it's created falsely doesn't last. So
mm-hmm.
I'm really, you know, it's really all about, is the audience responding in a way that is going to spread and grow?
Well, you threw out some pretty specific dollar figures, like $500 And I know that a lot of our listeners would be thrilled to be making 500 right. bucks a night. And, you know, I find myself thinking the same way, but I get this asked this question a lot. If things are, you know, returning to more live performance being the key in how artists make money in the future, how do they get to that level? Are there things you see artists specifically doing that to get beyond the, we made 50 bucks at the club tonight, we made 100 bucks?
Making more money at the club tonight is all about putting people in the room. The club owner will pay you more, and you're going to have to ask for it. He's not just going to volunteer it, but the club owner will pay you more the more people you put into the room. So it really is a question of doing whatever you have to do or can do to increase your draw. And, you know, I think a lot of that is about, you know, giving away music on the net, I think, you know, to help spread the word. I think a lot of it is about social networking, whether it's, you know, depending on your audience, it's MySpace, it's Facebook, it's iLike, it's, you know, those kinds of, Reverb Nation, in my opinion, has some fabulous free tools to use. And, you know, it's working every community that you have. If you're listening to this, you're probably selling your stuff on CD Baby. CD Baby is a fabulous community of people that love independent music. And, you know, what can you do to reach out to that audience? And, you know, but ultimately it's about how many people you can put in a room, and doing anything you can do to make that happen, I think, is a good thing. I open for other bands, trade gigs with other bands, treat every gig as if it's an event. I'm a real believer in that. You know, oh, we're playing it at, you know, so-and-so's next Thursday. Well, you know, what is it? Is it the day? Is it the day before Halloween? Is it somebody's birthday? Is it, what can you make it up? You know, can you charge $5 but buy a bunch of $2 white t-shirts that you silkscreen yourself, and everybody that comes through the door gets a t-shirt? You know, what can you do to make the date an event that people are going to then tell their friends about and want to come to the next event that you're going to do? And in the beginning, it's an immense amount of work for a very small amount of reward. But if your music's connecting with people, they'll tell other people, and then after a while, it gets easier.
Hearing you talk kind of reminded me of several conversations we've had on the podcast recently. Chris, who's on the joins in for the roundtable edition of the podcast, he's done several tours up and down the West Coast, and he's gotten amazing press in certain markets like the LA Times and things like that. And the Weekly's gotten great write-ups, but he really hasn't seen it translate into people coming out to the show in those cities. And it's something that we've discussed on the show, given our various opinions for why we think that's could be the case or whatnot. But it just seemed like, you know, 10 years ago, that would have been enough to fill the room.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole new world, and it's not always an easy one. I mean, two comments. One is that it's always been most difficult to get above the noise level in L.A. or New York or really any major market where there's a lot of other bands coming through and so much competition that, you know, yeah, you got a great write-up in L.A. Weekly and you got a great write-up in the L.A. Times. But if you really paid attention, so did 400 other bands last year because those newspapers write about bands every day or every week, you know, multiple bands every week. And, you know, there are so many choices on any given night that it's very hard to break through there. I would almost suggest to him, though, that the club booker in Sacramento is going to be more excited than anyone that, you know, hey, here's some good press. And if he makes him put the LA Times quote in the ads and on the front page of his website and the email blast that he does and the flyers that he does, that's the benefit to him of playing in LA and in the beginning anyway, and getting mm-hmm. those great quotes, is that other people are going to be impressed by it. Frankly, if you've ever lived in LA, which I did for a while, you know, you just get numb to it. look what the LA Times said. And I said, okay, well, look what they said about so-and-so yesterday and so-and-so the day before. And so, you know,
yeah,
it just is. And it's sad, but it's just the way it is. So, you know, I often, if I were a band, I wouldn't move to LA. I'd move to Fargo or, you know, some secondary market Probably not Fargo. the other cities are too far away. But someplace where there's a cluster of college towns or small to medium-sized cities that you can hone your craft and build an audience and make a living. And then all of a sudden, you know, by the time you come to L.A., there's momentum behind you. There's probably a team behind you. Maybe you've got some money to spend. Maybe there's a record label involved, you know, whatever that might be. And I also, you know, I'm a huge believer in the rise of the artistic middle class, if you will. I really do believe that making it in L.A. doesn't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. Making it in a bunch of cities that you can sustain and grow and go back to on a regular basis, that's what matters.
Well, and that kind of ties into the scenario with Chris on his tour. One of his best shows was like in Merced, California, Modesto. And when he told me that, he kind of chuckled. I'm like, no, those are the shows you want. Those are the towns where people want to hear new music. And it's not as maybe back in the 80s or 90s, that wasn't the cool place to play. But now those are the places where you can get people's attention, where L.A., they're just too busy with themselves to
pay attention. Well, I mean, you know, it depends on what your goal is. If your only goal is to attract a major label and get signed to a major label and then languish on the... Well, you know, to have all the bad things happen to you. If you're convinced that none of the bad things that happen to 80 or 90% of the artists that were signed to major label are not going to happen to you, and that's your goal, then that's... Playing in L.A. is way more important than playing in Merced. But the truth is, if your goal is to build an audience that can sustain your career and help you spend your life making music as opposed to selling tires, then that's Merced is just fine, you know. And play enough Merceds and LA will wonder what's going on and invite you and treat you a lot better.
Yeah, and I think the big picture for artists is that they just have to rework things in their brain. Like you said, I tell artists a lot, it's like, what are you trying to accomplish? Do you want to be famous or do you want to make money playing music? Because the two things are not the same thing.
That's right.
And just trying to educate artists to really define their goal and really pursue things in a way that helps meet those goals.
Well, and understand, too, where your audience is and worry about that. Don't worry about where, you know, Columbia Records or NBC Television or Rolling Stone are located. Worry about where your audience is. I mean, there are artists now that, you know, sustain careers by playing, you know, 20 or 30 countries and may only be able to play one or two cities in each of those countries, or maybe five in the U.S. and, you know, two in Spain and three in Romania. But because of the nature of their music, that's where their audience is, or because of lucky breaks in their career for, you know, radio stations or whatever, picking up on their music, it doesn't matter anymore because they can communicate with them if they've got a great website, if they're utilizing the tools that are available to them, you know, that if their stuff is on sale online, it doesn't matter anymore at where you are, and you can sustain that audience and go play for them and have them support you.
Have you seen any of your artists doing any unique or interesting ideas to get a crowd at their show or just in the live show in general that might be good to share with our audience?
I mean, you know, some of my favorites, basically I think it's all about engaging the audience. And, you know, one of my favorites, one of my bands does it, but the first time I saw it, I think it was Ozo Motley did it. You know, they end their last songs of their set with some of the band members coming out on into the audience, sort of engaging them in a line dance or something,
uh-huh.
Basically. And they eventually the whole band is off the stage. The audience is, you know, lined up behind them, dancing away and winding their way through the audience all the way to the merch table. And at the merch table, then the band stops and starts signing merch and selling T-shirts and doing whatever they can do. And they've got a built-in line of hundreds and hundreds of people standing at the merch table. I thought that's one of my favorites.
Oh, that's a good idea.
but you know, I think it's really all about anything that can engage the audience. You know, put a box in front of the stage and ask them, you know, to put songs in it that's their favorite cover song they'd like you to do, and and do one the next and dedicate it to somebody the next show, or anything you can do that can, as I say, engage your audience and help you relate to them, or help them relate to you, really.
I'm sure through Skyline, you've got plenty of experience dealing with club bookers and, mm-hmm. and people on the other end. Do you have advice for artists that are, you know, that have potential, that know that they can reach a broader audience or can make a living touring? Do you have some advice when they're starting out and having to engage with these people and make some breakthroughs?
Well, first of all, I'd say invest a little bit in good materials and you know, have a good picture, have a good website, have a good, you know, everything that you do is what's going to represent you. I mean, we know now, even at the level that we operate, when we're talking to somebody, a club buyer on the phone, he's on the web while we're talking to them, looking at the band's website. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he's looking at how many friends they have on Facebook. None of those things in and of themselves will make or break a deal, but it creates an impression. I mean, if you don't have a good website, if you don't have it together to have a good website, how are you going to have it together to bring people into his club or to do a great show? And is that fair? Probably not, but I can't blame them for thinking that. If you have no friends on MySpace or no plays in your tunes on MySpace, you know, do you really have an audience, or are you just making it up? Now, do they know that there are all kinds of ways to inflate those figures? Sure, but if you have none or very few, they start to get skeptical. So, I would say really invest a little bit in putting the infrastructure around you to look good, and then it's really about persistence. I'm a big fan of electronic press kits, whether it's the Sonic Bids ones or the Reverb Nation ones, or I think others have them, but I think that's an effective way to reach a club buyer sometimes. But so is printed material, and you've got to be persistent, you've got to be polite, and you're selling, you know, Tool as often as is humanly possible, as often as it's halfway true. Are I can put 50 people in your room, you know, I can put 100 people in your room, I can do something. I've got a record coming out, and next month the reviewer at the local weekly tells me it's going to be a feature. Can I get a gig to support that? Give the buyer a reason to say, okay, it's your turn, and then make the most out of it when he does.
We love mistake stories on the podcast. Do you have any mistake stories that you've seen artists do where you just went, oh no, please?
Oh, my God. There'd be thousands of them. I mean, I'm more, you know, I make them all the time. No, I think one grand mistake is believing that opening for the big bands is this is not a funny story, but it's just one that I'm always fighting. And, you know, I want to open for the Dave Matthews Band. I want to open. Well, the truth is that, you know, every year I probably get, you know, four or five, well, I don't want to say, I get a few opening act slots for the Dave Matthews Band, not because I'm a great agent, but because, you know, we know what they like. And, but I can tell you honestly, and no offense to the Dave Matthews Band, those openers mean almost nothing, as an example, because that audience is there to see Dave Matthews. So I guess what I'm trying to say in terms of the mistake is we see artists put so much energy into believing that one thing is the answer. Mm-hmm. We call it the magic door syndrome, meaning I know there's a magic door, and if I can just find the person who will open it for me, my career will be okay. Well, there isn't a magic door other than making great music, and often that isn't enough, sadly. It's about a lot of little doors that you're going to go through over the course of your career.
Well said. Well said.
Hey, probably not your best mistake story. I'm sorry. I'll try and
No, but that is an interesting point that I would agree wholeheartedly with, that I don't know that we've ever brought up on the podcast before. When the band I was in was signed to a label, we had some friends of ours that were also signed, and they got on a tour for a really large act, and they were the opening band. Mm-hmm. And it did absolutely nothing for their career. And the record right. company had to pay a lot to get them on that slot. And they thought it would be kind of a golden opportunity. And it turned out that half the time, it was small arenas they were playing in. And a good portion of the time, not even a fourth of the crowd was there when they were playing.
Right. And even if they were there, they were there talking about you know, the headlining band, because that's really who they pay the money to see. And we see it all the time, and, you know, we'll put an act on the Warped Tour, and they'll be on the second stage. You know, do I think the band should do it if the opportunity arises? Absolutely, because if, you know, 200 people fall in love with you because of that show, that's 200 more in that town. But do I think it's the be-all and end-all? No, it's absolutely not.
Yeah. Well, do you have your eye on anything on the horizon that you think is some interesting developments in the industry, knowing that you read 100-plus blogs a day?
I guess I'm most excited by the fact that there seem to be finally a group, an increasing number of independent labels that matter in the sense that, you know, they survive for more than 5 years and they actually do things to help their artists. So that, in other words, there is a place to go for somebody who doesn't want to go completely DIY anymore, that or understands the pitfalls of the major label. There's a middle ground. I think that's exciting. I think it's exciting that finally there seem to be tools that actually work. You know, there's by nature of writing Hypebot, I probably get 5 or 6 new websites a day, literally, that say, well, we do this and we do that. Well, there finally are some that we're seeing that are starting to stick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it used to be if you talked about, I'm not saying this to make you feel good, but it used to be if you talked, even 2 years ago or 3 years ago, if you wanted to talk about a successful business that serviced indie music, basically it was CD Baby and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are more. And last but not least, I see, and this is something you'll see a lot more of, I think, looking into the coming months, I see that there are increasingly good analytical tools, and there will be more. There are a couple companies that are going to go open up their platforms literally in the next few weeks that'll help bands, either for free or for very little money, a few bucks a month or something, measure and find what's going on for them in the web, and it was what matters. Like, which matters more for you, having 622 friends on Facebook or 2,000 friends on MySpace? Well, it's different for every band, and there are tools that are coming down the pike that will help you do that and help you spend your energies in places that matter for you. And that's exciting stuff, because that means all this work that we're doing might be you know, for a reason rather than, I think this is working. So I think those are the trends.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that is definitely one problem with the web. It's so decentralized. It's hard to tell where people are and what's working. And you can get a little viral activity going on the web that's working, but it's hard to make that translate into real action as far as shows sometimes. And
yeah, I mean, for example, I'd say, like, right today, any band that doesn't have Google Analytics, you know, linked into their site, you know, needs to go do that tomorrow. It's free. You probably can follow instructions how to do it yourself, or your webmaster should be able to do it for, you know, $10 in 2 minutes or maybe 10 minutes. And you can start looking at where's all, you know, people are coming to my website. How are they getting there?
Mm-hmm.
They're getting there because they're Googling my name. Oh, maybe I should spend a little more money on Google advertising. They're getting there because of a blog post that was written about me three states over 2 months ago that I missed entirely.
Yeah.
You know, those are the kind of things that you need to pay attention to. And you can see that. You can see where your incoming traffic is with Google Analytics. And there are other tools, but that's a free one.
Yeah, and that's a good point as well, because I use that for the podcast, and it's amazing how many times someone will write a nice article or something and you didn't even know it was there, and it gives you the opportunity to at least thank them and build that relationship and know, okay.
And build that relationship and make sure that they get your next piece of music when it comes out, or they know the next time you're coming through town with a gig, or, you know, in your case, the next time you have some exciting, you know, new thing to tell them about. And that's, it's really important.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's going to bring us to the end of another episode. I want to thank Bruce for coming on the show, and would encourage you to check out his blog at hypebot.com. We'll put a link to that in the show notes found at cdbabypodcast.com. And while you're at the podcast website, feel free to weigh in by leaving a comment on the episode, or you can email us through the site. Plus, we love getting your phone calls that we always play on the roundtable edition of the show. And to call in and leave us a message, just call 206-426-5000. 5683. And you can weigh in on the episode or share thoughts, comments on just about anything related to music and your pursuit of music. And we love hearing about your mistakes or successes as well. So feel free to call in and leave us a message, and we'll try and get it on the show. Well, that's all for now. We'll catch you next time. You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.